Welcome to EI Talks, the podcast that takes ideas seriously. I'm Paul Lay, Senior Editor at Engelsberg Ideas, and I'm joined by Deputy Editor of EI, Alistair Benn. And today we welcome Matt Heffler to EI Talks. Matt is Postdoctoral Fellow at the Axon Johnson Institute for Statecraft and Diplomacy. And we spoke with him in Sweden, where he's organised an intelligence and security seminar for the Institute. Welcome, Matt. The outbreak of war in Ukraine and in the Middle East has underscored a number of themes in international conflicts, which have been outlined by Matthew. Would you like to go through those themes, Matthew, that you've focused on when looking at the recent outbreaks of international conflicts?
Certainly. Thank you both so much for having me. And when we saw the outbreak of conflict in the Ukraine and Russia's invasion of the country, even in the lead up and then ever since, we've seen a number of themes in both conflict, but also the role of secret intelligence and intelligence services around conflict really underscored. Yeah. And Some of the just to name a couple that really stuck out in the beginning were first the role of intelligence services around what might be termed public diplomacy, but really in stepping forth and by the UK and the US in declassifying virtually in real time intelligence that revealed Russian intentions or future Russian moves. And then, and that's one issue that can be unpacked. And then once the conflict really began, we've seen an incredible amount of sharing between Western allies, including the leaders in the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Alliance with Ukraine, and then a variety of things, including the growth of open source kind of freelancers, but also more professional outlets, including Bellingcat and the like. So between actually on the ground and how operations are shaped, but also all the way up to the political level and the strategic level, we've seen all these themes underscored during this conflict.
And were you surprised when you talk about the US and the UK declassifying intelligence? Were you surprised how smoothly that came about and how quickly that came about?
Yes, I think that many people were surprised by, at least the narrative from this event seems to be, from these declassifications, seems to be that it was quite an effective maneuver by the UK and the USA in making these declassifications. It is quite a dramatic decision to be deciding to risk to the degree that you are risking sources and methods by releasing secret information in order to play this really public role that is sometimes not the most natural one for intelligence services to play. But the narrative around Ukraine, I think, is that this was quite an effective maneuver to check to some degree Russian intentions or Russian efforts that might be towards disinformation or misinformation around their intentions, but also I think to bring a level of cohesion to the Western alliance in the public sphere, in making certain facts undeniable and shaping the discourse in that way. I would only just say that when it comes to this level of relative success with these declassifications is I think we see now that there's an increasing acceptance among certainly like intelligence services connected with the U.S. State Department that they see a growing appetite for this as a tactic in international diplomacy, and I think we'll see this increasingly formalized in some way, which will bring its own set of challenges.
Are there precedents for the release of information in this way?
There absolutely are, and we've seen really important ones in the past. We've got terrific experts at this event here who are going to speak about things like Calder Walton of the Belfer Center at Harvard University is going to speak about the history of U.S. intelligence declassifications and really touch on some of the big ones. We've seen times that have been that might be considered more effective and times that have been considered much more questionable in their results. One example is, of course, the intelligence around WMDs in Iraq, which has led to much scrutiny of the practice, and I think speaks to how when I've seen that described as kind of intelligence that was not quite too politicized, too quickly delivered. Yeah, yeah. But then we've also seen other times of it used, I think, more effectively.
Okay. And is there a sense, unpacking this, of the way in which we think about the actual practical benefits to Ukraine or other allies of this release of information. But because of the public nature of it, there is a sense in which it's also propaganda. Would that be a fair assessment? And is it difficult, if that's the case, to pick out what is real and what is there in a very public way through propaganda, or do the two elide in some way?
That's a great question, Paul, and I think you're absolutely on the money there. One way that I believe this can be framed is when looking, for instance, at the UK's Defence Intelligence Update, that has been a very public effort to be using a mixture of open source material and some classified material in a way that can continue to play the role of the transparent open voice in this in a very contested information space. Now, to your point, there's a lot that goes into those sorts of decisions, especially on a quick daily basis. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely a risk that the source coming from the UK's intelligence services and defense organizations, that automatically brings upon it a bit of almost an attempt at manipulation.
Yeah. Spin.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Because of course the government is making this conscious effort to shape a narrative in a certain way.
Of course, yeah.
But it's also trying to navigate a number of other things along with transparency, security, and contest with the activities of adversaries. So we really see a lot going on in that, and that's a really good example, but it's not a simple one.
Okay.
In the 18th and 17th century, states do release correspondence between rulers in the Ancien Régime
and diplomats,
about potential allies, secret diplomatic correspondence. They do release them fairly spectacularly to try and shape the politics of the moment. Is the Cold War actually more interesting as an exception to the rule of using intelligence to get what you want?
I think my first reaction to that is that intelligence material and the work of intelligence services really changes and varies over time, and it's understood in various ways over time. And so to your point there, you're absolutely right, and we've seen in the early modern period a huge growth in the activities of kind of the secret side of the state and of governing. And as another expert here, John Ferris, at our event here would note, is this really falls to some degree during the 19th century. Sort of the signals or the cryptographical side of things, to point to one example. During the Cold War, I think we see a lot going on, including a real formalization of the, at least certainly the Anglo-American, but other intelligence services in the world that was driven by first the First World War, that saw an incredible development in the structure and the processes of services in the West, especially the very famed Room 40 in the UK that solved the Zimmerman telegram.
Yeah.
And then in the interwar period, services vary at different sides depending on how they were supported. And then when it comes to the Second World War, we of course know some of the story there around Bletchley Park and breaking of Enigma and the resources that were required both in that and the establishment of the Anglo-American special relationship on the intelligence front there.
Coming back to this idea of diplomacy, I'm very interested in the way this is played out, this kind of culture of intelligence. Obviously, what's been going on between UK, US, initially, both privately and publicly, how much is that aimed at? It's obviously aimed at Russia, plainly. But how much is it also aimed at potential allies? And how is that used? Because obviously there's US-UK taking a lead, but we've obviously seen a huge increase in aid, say, from European states, Germany we think of, countries in Scandinavia. How much does that play a role as well? Is it's not just a message for your enemies potentially, it's also a message for your allies?
Absolutely. And it's one of the aspects, I think, of declassifications or this sort of public-facing role of services that really fascinates me. I think there's a strong argument to be made that, yes, certainly we saw a direct attempt to position the Western position against a Russian position, attempt to preempt or pre-bunk, as they use in this instance, possible narratives that Russia might try to employ in part to divide the West.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there's a really interesting angle to these declassifications that make it that contributed to a cohesion in the Western alliance in its an early response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, in part because of making it really difficult to certain approaches in various countries around the world that might be more hesitant or might be more reluctant to adopt a confrontational stance against the Russian action. It made it a little bit more difficult to take those stances without at least addressing what had been established through these declassifications. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I think we really saw an interesting way that this intelligence could contribute to a public discourse across borders and state to state. Mm.
Is the function also to promote embarrassment and to potentially infuriate your enemies and also signal to potential enemies or you know, people who maybe swing both ways in the kind of global game that, you know, if you become our enemies, we can embarrass you, you know, because I felt when I saw a lot of this intelligence splashed on Mail Online of all places or in every Western newspaper, it looks embarrassing to the Russians. And I wonder whether what happens then in the kind of Russian elite and its security, they sort of go, well, this just looks a bit ridiculous. and being made to feel ridiculous, as we know, is actually can make people act emotionally. It can make people do overreach. It can make people do irrational things. I wonder if it's one of those human things.
I think it's a good question, Alistair. I think for me, first of all, just it's very difficult, of course, to guess at what leaders or different organizations within our own organizations, let alone adversarial groups, are thinking or how they're responding. But I do think that you've really touched on something as far as you're really sending a strong signal to the services, intelligence services and security services of a state like Russia, I think, that you're willing to reveal certain information that you have, willing to, at least in theory, risk some sources and methods that provided you with that, at least open a greater possibility that some of this can be worked back upon and tracked down. So there's a very jarring, I think, and dramatic aspect to it. When it comes to a more humiliation or shock value, I think that's really true. But I do agree with you that it would be more at the higher level and in the services themselves, a kind of more an arm's length from more public feeling. But that's just my gut reaction to that.
And when it comes to the real intelligence, Matthew, the way it's used practically, forget the diplomacy, forget the propaganda aspect of this, what effect is it having in Ukraine on the battlefield, you know, strategically, tactically? And what is Ukraine's contribution itself to that?
This is a really interesting one. And again, we've been able to bring a few experts in who are really focusing on how both technology, but also technologies interacting with diplomacy or contemporary means of conflict in order to see how this conflict is actually playing out. I think one of the first things that we would have to consider here is what we've seen is a dramatic use of open source intelligence here. And
just explain what that is for those who don't understand.
Absolutely. And so open source intelligence refers to intelligence material that is available openly by means that anyone possesses. And this is material anywhere from newspapers, et cetera, to increasingly today, commercial satellites, all the way up and everything in between. And so that has had a real effect on this war and certainly when you look at it from a narrative sense on Twitter or other social medias, which again is really one very particular view of the conflict and one that shouldn't be oversold. But that said, that's a really important one for when open source satellites, for instance, when we talk about declassifications, are able to confirm what is being released by agencies in the UK or the USA, that goes a long way to reducing some of the risk of A, that your sources and methods will be able to be reconstructed, or two, that that you'll be wrong.
Yeah.
When it can be confirmed. And that's a really important thing for declassifications, is that you're working on really credible and serious intelligence. On the ground, you'll have to speak to better people than me, but when we talk about drones and that sort of information, Ukraine's playing an incredibly vital role, not just in their resistance to this invasion, but through the way that they are innovating on the ground in difficult circumstances to produce more intelligence and to act on the intelligence they receive from Western allies.
And how would you regard Russia's response? What would your judgment be so far as Russia's response to these innovations that the Ukraine has developed?
I think, as far as I can tell from an outside look, is that Russia has seemingly really been adapting to the situation. We already saw during the most recent Ukraine offensive that sheerly on the ground through preparation and mines and fortifications, the Russian armed forces had really altered their position and strengthened their position in order to blunt the effects of this. I think you also would see this in the realm of the information angles of this campaign, both including how they are stopping, how they're able to use equipment in order to hijack cell phone signals in various areas, and really focusing on that angle where previously, when the invasion force first entered, they were using open phones or getting Ukrainian phones and using them on signals that could be tapped in order to because they couldn't use Russian ones because those had been blocked, those SIMs. So even with those sorts of changes that sound somewhat contained, I think they're having I think we're seeing a level of impact in operations.
Do you think it's fair to say that Russia is surpassing Ukraine, or do you think it's two fighters slugging it out in a really quite long battle potentially?
I'm afraid that I really can't say. I think that while we've seen, of course, some of the discussion now is about what the outcome of the offensive was and how we classify it and what that sort of means, I think it's all discussions are considering whether it is kind of becoming a quote unquote stalemate, but whether what that exactly tells us, even if it's true, is not easy to say. And it kind of depends on a degree of support that has continued to be able to be provided to Ukrainians, and also the way that other events in the international scene may or may not take either focus or take the will of certain supporters to support Ukraine as fulsomely as they have been. Mm-hmm.
Do you get the sense that there are some divisions opening up between the elements of the Ukrainian security services and Western capitals because of some of the, shall we say, more spectacular operations that they've attempted and that have played out over the last couple of years? There seems to be a lot of chatter about differences between what our agencies and our leadership want and what the Kyiv leadership wants and how it relates to its own security services.
Yes, it's a very important question. And of course, I think that you're right to touch on considerations currently about possible Ukrainian activities further behind Russian lines or at Russia's bases of supply or industry. And those are things that are definitely worth watching, and I think that we'll see our national security journalists continue to watch very closely. I think my initial reaction is to touch on kind of the very complex way that intelligence liaison works between countries, and especially between a country in a situation like Ukraine fighting for its national future and Western allies. So on just in a that are kind of trying to help from a distance, of a degree of distance, on one sense, both in an intelligence sense or in a sense of military operations, I think the Ukrainians have time and again shown that they are on the line, that they are again and again the best observers of what's happening, and mm-hmm. sometimes often the best decision makers of how to use either the aid they've been given or the resources at their control to fight their corner. But I would just say that intelligence relationships between states are exceptionally difficult to get a good picture of in a contemporary setting, and really, I would argue, require as an archival historian, I would argue this, that you really need a lot more material, accounts down the line, and accounts that need to be able to be disentangled from what they were able to say or not, and then kind of putting them up against the results. And you really need that kind of hindsight to get a better sense of it. Up until then, yes, we're seeing really good reporting on whether there's divisions or whether there might be some disputes. But I would argue that we must be incredibly cautious around what we think might be happening or how that's impacting the larger relationship.
Yeah, and that will be a job for future historians, of course, to untangle that. And just one final point. With intelligence, there's a lot of theorizing about the nature of intelligence until the real thing happens in conflict. And we've had this terrible conflict in Ukraine. What has surprised you most about the role of intelligence now that the conflict has come about that perhaps you wouldn't have thought from theorizing before the conflict, if you see what I mean?
I think I do see what you mean. And the conflict has underscored so many angles of intelligence that it's hard to choose the one that I think would be worth highlighting here. But for me, I would have to say that what is most surprising, regardless of its outcome, has been the, again, back to reporting that we need to be careful on, but the level of intelligence sharing with Ukraine by the Western allies. Mm-hmm. And by the Western allies, in particular, the Anglophone countries in the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Alliance.
Just explain, people, what the Five Eyes is to those who don't know.
Certainly. And so the Five Eyes is a group of five English-speaking countries, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the United States, that was established in the years following the Second World War, built around the core of the UK-USA intelligence sharing alliance that came out of the Second World War and that was understood to be both incredibly valuable and that also was essential to continue for the security between these states in the post-war world. And it's incredibly exclusive to the point that you'll see examples in the NATO alliance where people who are ranks of higher ranks from other countries might not be receiving the intelligence that lower ranks might be receiving who are members of the Five Eyes and adding to the complicated relations there. Mm. And I use that example because we've seen such an expansion of sharing of secret material from this very exclusive club with the Ukrainians in a way that really makes a strong statement about trying to support their cause, but also I think without giving any judgment, is likely unprecedented in the history of the alliance.
Mm. And why do you think that's happened? Why is it Ukraine that is that outlier?
Because of the importance that the UK and the US, as the leaders of the Five Eyes, have placed and supported by their allies both within the intelligence group and outside, have placed on the effort and the sacrifices being made by the Ukrainians in resisting this invasion. That's the first reaction that comes to mind, and I think it's probably one that can stand. And so with that, I think these are what's helping making some of these hard decisions when you're deciding what you can try to release. And I think that when we look at these, back to Alistair's point about the nature of intelligence liaison, I think we see these build over time, just as the UK USA relationship was developed through very difficult circumstances of the Second World War and then developed over a long period, and I think we're seeing to some degree a different form of relationship build with allies in Ukraine. So we'll have to see how it develops.
And conflict accelerates these relationships.
It both can accelerate it, but it also goes a long way to creating the circumstances that brings interests into line that make countries decide that it's in their interest to work together and take certain a level of risk.
And you think that alliance will hold?
Well, I certainly expect that support for Ukraine will remain a strong feature in many of the Western Alliance countries. That's for sure.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you, Matthew. That was really fascinating. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you
by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.